It's time for the Access of Easy podcast, the weekly technology digest that keeps you ahead of the curve. Brought to you by EasyDNS.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Access of Easy podcast, companion, the brother to the Access of Easy newsletter. This is number 310. You can sign up for the newsletter at accessofeasy.com. If you sign up, Mark and team will give you a little bit of a discount on the first thing you buy from EasyDNS, which you can't beat. And of course, you can sign up for this podcast in your favorite podcast catcher, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. Did I get them all? How many are there? There's got to be hundreds of them now.
Fountain. Is it listed on Fountain? I would love to. I'm going to take a peek, but you know what? Forget it. If it's there, great. If not, it should be added.
We got to find out. I'm going to look really quickly here. That's my co-host, Len, if you're joining us for the first time. I know that last week I said I would read any reviews we got in the podcast app. So I better go
and
look
and see if we got it. No, not available on Fountain. The people behind Access of Easy, add this to Fountain. Get it done.
Let's see here. What do we got?
And if you haven't left a review, you might as well do so. Look, we're reading them. And if it's good, we'll read it. If it's bad, we'll read it and improve the product at the same time. So it's a... We are going to take that information and on the fly we will adapt.
I have no idea how to read the reviews, but it looks like we have 5 ratings on the podcast.
Thank you.
I don't know. Maybe I can't read them because I'm not the proprietor. Is that why you think? I never really thought about that.
I don't know. I use Fountain as my primary podcast app, and from there I could easily see everything, but it's only for Fountain related stuff. So anything that's outside that ecosystem, if it's Google, Apple, Spotify, you name it, I don't get it. So
I gotta think about this. We gotta find a way. Anyway, so as always, we're gonna start with last week's quote. Nothing can stop the man with the right mental attitude from achieving his goal, and nothing on earth can help the man with the wrong mental attitude. That was Thomas Jefferson, and Joe got it right. Congrats, Joe. Great name as well. This week's quote: a person often meets his destiny on the road he took to avoid it. Interesting. That sounds like something I might have seen at the end of a meal at the Mandarin in a fortune cookie once or twice. What do you think? Is that a good quote? That seems like an easy one, but it's familiar, but not familiar enough.
The beautiful thing, we could have centuries of data here that we could mine to create some of these sayings and pull them and use them. So we're never going to run out. And a lot of them are, you know, I have no idea who said that one. No clue. And hopefully somebody does, because you know what? They're going to get a bonus if they do.
Yeah. Big chunk of renewal fees. It's on the house, actually. So you can't really beat that. If you got a domain with these DNS, the renewal's on Mark. As always, no cheating. Don't look it up. Don't Google it. None of that stuff. And Len, with that, I think we can get into it. We got a handful of stories this week. One, finally, on WorldCoin. Finally. We're like 3 weeks into this. We didn't get a WorldCoin story until today.
Yeah, it's Mark, why included? Anyways, let's talk about WorldCoin, the open source protocol. And this has a native token for their network called WorldCoin. Interesting name. It's very creative.
0 out of 5. Yeah.
The ticker is WLD. I took a look to see earlier today what was the price of it. It was a little bit under $1.70 for the coin per token. And it was down 10% for today. So a lot of people are dumping their tokens for obvious reasons. Now, Sam Altman, he's the OpenAI chief executive officer. He's also the co-founder and CEO of WorldCoin. So, we'll be talking about this in just a second. What is so special about WorldCoin and its potential connection with OpenAI? WorldCoin is used by scanning a user's eye, and this creates a digital identity and grants the holder, I can't believe I'm saying this, proof of personhood. Proof of personhood. And all this is done by using the infamous WorldCoin orb. And why would anybody subject themselves to having their eye scanned by the WorldCoin orb. Well, they are going to be given something in return. In this case, it's going to be WorldCoin tokens. A scan of the eye will result in the user getting 25 of these WorldCoin tokens just for submitting their eyes and getting it scanned. So what is the value of that? Again, as of earlier today, around $1.70. That's around $42.50. The price may change as at the time of this recording. I do not know. And these eye scans sessions are run by what they called orb operators. And these operators are, let's be honest, they're influencers, right? They can encourage people to give up their precious biometric data in exchange for, well, almost nothing, $42. They're targeting people of lesser means and doing so in poorer countries. WorldCoin is currently barred to be used in the United States. Kenya has also added their name to that list. They recently barred them as well because they're outlying it due to security concerns. The company, they say, when talking about WorldCoin, they say that the data is encrypted. I'm talking about the data that's used for scanning somebody's eyes, and it's used a technique called zero knowledge proofs. And they say this is impossible to decrypt the data without the user's consent. I've heard this all before and even heard this from publicly traded companies. Why does this all matter to us? Well, what is the link between scanning your eye and ChatGPT or OpenAI? I don't know, but there is a case here that we could link the two together, more so than just Sam Altman. ChatGPT is all about gathering data. The more data it has possession of, the more powerful of a tool it is to use. And also with gathering all this data, it is also a centralized location and a prime suspect to be attacked by a government to apprehend this data. So going all about this, $42, giving up your private data, biometric data, this shit should be considered sacred to people, but people are willing to give up their privacy for money and even making their lives easier. We've seen this time and time again. This stuff is, it drives me absolutely bonkers. It almost makes me like vomit. Like it's so bad to me. Like, but you know what? People are willing to do it. It's their choice. They're going to have to live with the consequences.
Yeah, I think the other problem is that it looks like governments are going to have access to the data. Obviously, you know, it goes without saying that this was going to happen. The only thing I don't understand is, you know, Reclaim the Net, who does a lot of the stories that we talked about on this program, why did they use the word controversial in the title? Controversial eyeball scanning WorldCoin to allow governments to use its digital ID system. Controversial implies there are people who think this is a good idea and people think this is a bad idea. I don't know anyone who thinks it's a good idea. I know people who are willing to accept the bad idea for the $40. Third world, obviously, there's been a couple of governments speaking ill, and I think Kenya banned the WorldCoin orbs, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is clearly a problem. I don't think there's anyone who thinks it's a good idea. I think there are people who are desperate enough to suffer, you know, grin and bear it, as they say. I can't imagine, Len, that this is going to end well. I mean, what are we talking about here? Talk about a honeypot. Proof of personhood, people's retinas, like, you know, people use retina scans for a number of different things. I think Amazon's, what is the name of that grocery store that Amazon owns now? I forget, but they're doing palm scanning. I know even at a place like Skydome, the Rogers Center in Toronto, the Blue Jays just introduced, if you can believe this, a system where there's a room in the stadium on the mezzanine level, one of the mezzanines, where you walk in, scan your credit card when you walk in. It basically, the system tags you with the credit card, watches you pick stuff out, and then you walk out with the stuff. It's only going to get worse. Why would you want to give more information to these companies? Very much unproven. And by the way, how many times have we talked about OpenAI losing data or getting hacked or not getting hacked, but you know, being part of broader scams on this air? A handful, at least. I mean, this Altman guy, I don't know, WorldCon. Freudian slip there, maybe. I mean, Freudian slip. So, yeah, there you go. I don't know what to say about this. It's obvious this is a bad idea, but like so many other bad ideas, we're going to see what happens, I guess. Let's go for it.
Is there any difference between this and, say, what Apple or Google does with their phones? Is there, people are giving up biometric data just to make their life easier,
yeah,
to access their phones or talk to it,
I think,
or whatever.
I think there's some case we made that there's some similarities, and some cases to me that there's some differences. But I think at the very least, you know, to date, Apple has not had a problem with biometrics leaking. Doesn't mean they never will, but OpenAI is, a young company by all accounts, not quite as careful with the data. And it seems in this article, much more willing to play ball with governments than Apple has been traditionally. So I don't know. All in all, I mean, there's not a good way to give up your biometrics. I say that as an iPhone user, right? I know that I'm taking a chance when I scan my face to open my phone.
And that's essentially it. People are willing to do that just for the convenience of something. And well, people need to take ownership of this, because privacy is a currency and we shouldn't be selling it for simply $40 or even just opening a phone for quick and easy use.
At least in the phone's case, I think Google's phones do this too. It's locally stored only, right? So at least there's no like honeypot. I think that's what they say anyway.
Bro. Again, you know, when information is that valuable, without analyzing the code, it's all you could rely on is somebody's word. And that's something I don't want to rely on with something as precious as my data. But you know what? Each their own. IPv6.
Let's do it.
We have never talked about IPv6 at all. And it's a subject that I've been hearing about for several decades now. Look, before we talk about IPv6, let's talk about IPv4. And this is the most commonly used thing that we know today that we use in TCP/IP. You know, 192.168.0.1 subnet mask, the whole nine yards. Everybody hopefully is familiar with this stuff. Mm-hmm. IPv4 has some limitations. And one of it uses 32-bit addresses. And if you extrapolate that, it translates to around 4.2, almost 4.3 billion addresses in total. So looking at that number, the number is rapidly depleting in terms of how many addresses are remaining, and because more and more devices are just being added to the internet. Another issue with IPv4 is it has inefficient routing. Its routing system is based on classic networks, and the system is inefficient and it can lead to congestion of a network. Another thing, there's lack of security. IPv4 does not have built-in security features and it makes it vulnerable to attacks. And there's also a lack of support of new features for IPv4. This thing is very old, so support of new features like quality of service and mobility, just it's tough to include, if not impossible to do so. So as I mentioned, they're running out of addresses, and this has been discussed for decades. I've heard this back in the late 90s, in fact. Some creative measures have been employed to get around this address issue in terms of running out, but ultimately we'll have to migrate to IPv6. There's no way around it. And one of the things that IPv6 has is way more addresses. And somebody may ask how many. Okay, I'm going to give you the gist of it. Imagine a number 3 followed by 38 zeros. I have no idea what number, like gajillion million, I don't know. But 3 followed by 38 zeros. That's how many addresses are available on IPv6. So that's a huge difference between the two. And there's one way to push for people to use IPv6. And you could do so by having cloud operators such as AWS, Azure, and others to start charging people to use public IPv4 addresses. So there are a lot of things that you could come along with this. Potentially, if they do this, there could be some issues with implementing IPv6 with what you're using IPv4. There could be some compatibility issues. Poor documentation may exist for IPv6 compared to IPv4. Lack of awareness may be another thing, but most importantly, it could be a lack of support. So it may be hard to obtain any support if you're trying to migrate to IPv6. But this is something that is going to be coming out in not too distant future. Somebody by the name of Matthew Dugan, I'm not sure. He argued that the problems are not insurmountable. And we will need to address these IPv6 issues soon, very, very soon, because it could be widely adopted. It should be widely adopted. He suggests that providers, device manufacturers, and software developers need to do more to support IPv6. And we should be getting more educational resources that should be available to end users. And looking at this, IPv6 is something you're going to be hearing a lot more in the future. There are a lot of benefits from using it, but it's not going to be a seamless transition from IPv4 to IPv6. But if there's ever a global transition and it gets there, the benefits will far outweigh the drawbacks. But unfortunately, it's going to take some time to get there.
The security should be reason enough, should it not? I mean, like what is the other nudge you need? It looks like the cloud providers are not really doing their part, at least not yet. But the security of changing over is important. We talk a lot on the show about how with all the data floating around out there and all the different ways people can get that data through, you know, you being socially engineered or passwords being nicked or man-in-the-middle attacks of different kinds and all these different things we've discussed. This seems like something that you could presumably do without really doing much on your end at all, right? When you set up an address, you just ask for that standard, but people are not doing it for various reasons. It's weird that this is not the case. It's like, there's an old saying in product development where if two products are similar in function, to get someone off of the product they're using, your product has to really be, 5x better or 10x better. It can't just be a little bit better. And I think that's what you're seeing here. This seems to me like a product of that kind of thinking. I'm not familiar enough or technologically savvy enough to know whether or not there's stuff that Matt Dugan isn't saying here that's actually keeping people on the other standard, but I'd be curious to find out. I wonder if people who are listening and watching this can tell us, because I think it's never quite as easy as an article like this would make it seem. And this article doesn't make it seem that easy, to be honest with you, but it's one side of the argument. I'd like to hear the other side as well.
One thing to note is that all devices that we have nowadays, they're all IPv6 compatible. Unless you have something that's ancient, it probably isn't compatible. But anything that you purchased in the past, say, decade or so, maybe a little bit less, it's IPv6 compatible. Even Bitcoin is IPv6 compatible. So that's something else that I just want to bring up. Let's talk about the Prospect Medical Holdings. They were targeted in a countrywide U.S. primary care cyber attack. And this happened on April 3rd, 2023. So it was a cyber attack targeting the computer systems of Prospect Medical Holdings. It's a California-based company that operates hospitals and clinics in Texas, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Pennsylvania. The attack caused significant disruptions to the company's operations, including the closure of emergency rooms in multiple states and a diversion of ambulances. The attack is believed to have been carried out by a ransomware group, which demanded a ransomware payment for decrypting the company's data. And the company has refused to pay the ransom, and the system remained offline as of August 10th. And I'm not sure if it's been on reinstated since, but as of recording, I think it's still offline. So the attack has had significant impact on patients and staff of the Prospect Medical Holdings facilities. And patients have been unable to access care, and staff have been forced to work without access to critical information, which is amazing considering the fact that you're dealing with people that are in dire medical straits. And if you do something wrong, it could be catastrophic. The attack really is a reminder that there's a growing threat of cyber attacks, especially to the healthcare sector. And healthcare organizations are increasingly targeted by ransomware groups. It's low-hanging fruit. And they see them as being vulnerable and having valuable data. Checkbox on both parts there. And health organizations need to take steps to protect themselves from cyber attacks, such as implementing strong security measures and having a plan in place in case there is a breach. A person by name of Andy Choudhury, God, I hope I pronounced the name right, the CEO of Dasera, is a cybersecurity firm, said the attack highlights the urgent need for these places to improve their security posture. He says it's also a wake-up call for the industry itself to show that they are immune to cyber attacks. This is pretty scary stuff, and this is probably going to happen more so moving forward, as a lot of our data is centralized in these databases that these medical centers hold or these hospitals hold. And if it is really low-hanging fruit, and if somebody's able to compromise it, it's going to be hard to keep the systems offline, especially if people's health is at risk. People are willing to pay anything when they're injured or sick. And the people that are responsible for holding it, man, they might just have to bend over and give it and take it up the rear end, because there's nothing else that they could do. That's just this is a sad state of affairs over there. And hopefully everybody could get access to their medical care.
It's happening here too. I think one of the things we look past, I know this is an American story, but like if we could just spin this to Canada for a second as well, because I think this is probably true in both countries. And I would guess in Europe, you're seeing something similar in the major metropolitan centers. We talk a lot about crumbling infrastructure. And when people think about crumbling infrastructure, and specifically here in Canada, healthcare unable to meet the needs of the growing population, et cetera, the aging population as well, of course, people often think of hospital beds, the buildings, the materials, the equipment, things like that. that are in the physical realm that are going to prevent you from being able to get the care you need when you need it. But often we're not thinking about the technological infrastructure that's also aged out. If you've ever been to a hospital or seen what goes on in a hospital administrative area, those computer systems are not up to date. And you and I joke a little bit about how the governments are falling behind as well. Like they're not patching Windows. They're not doing Windows updates, for God's sake. Hospitals are, I think, very much in the same boat. And it's scary because when you know you need something as far as equipment, you need an X-ray machine, you don't have one or it's broken. Okay, there's other X-ray machines we can go to. But if you got a problem in your infrastructure from the cybersecurity side, how are you going to know? You're not going to know until it's too late. You're not going to know until the information is leaked or gone or locked or whatever, or incorrect, costs lives. And that's dangerous stuff. People don't think about that enough because our politicians are concerned about more tangible promises that, look good in campaigns than they are about updating computer systems. But this is a great example of why you can't overlook the latter.
They should institute IPv6. Maybe that's one way that they can secure their data. But
maybe that's it.
With the old equipment they have, maybe it's just not possible. And the reason why they have a lot of old equipment is because it's been tried, tested, and true. They know that it's going to work.
They need redundancy, right? Like, it's hard. You can't just replace a system like that all at once. You basically have to build on top of the old system because you can't afford to lose what you have at any point. It's a difficult conundrum they find themselves in, but it's important to find a solution. Like, I don't want to give them a pat on the back for not losing everything when they're fudging things up different ways. It's not what I think is the best outcome. But anyway, yeah, lots to think about there. It's a struggle that I think is going to come for a lot of first world nations over the next 10 or 15 years.
Struggle is a good word we could use for the next one, because we're talking about the Supreme Court, and it's going to be holding the fate of the internet in its hands. And the Supreme Court is considering a case that could have a major impact on the way online platforms moderate content. The case, called NetChoice v. Paxton, pits two trade associations, NetChoice and the Computer and Communications Industry Association, CCIA, against the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. So NetChoice and CCIA argued that the Texas law would allow state residents to sue online platforms for moderating content in a way that is deemed unfair or discriminatory. And this would be violations of the First Amendment. They argue that the law would force platforms to host content that they believe is harmful and illegal, and it would chill their speech. Paxton argues that the law is necessary to protect free speech. He argues that the platforms have become too powerful and that they are using their power to censor conservative voices. He also argues that the law is narrowly tailored to address the problem of platform censorship and that it does not violate the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court is expected to rule on this case in the coming months, probably this year. The outcome of the case is going to obviously have major impact on the way online platforms moderate content. And if the law is upheld, it can make it more difficult for platforms to remove harmful or illegal content. It could also chill their speech and make them more reluctant to take action against hate speech or misinformation. And the case is also significant because it raises important questions about the First Amendment and the role of online platforms in society. The Supreme Court will need to decide whether online platforms are entitled to the same First Amendment protections as traditional publishers. Very, very interesting here.
Yeah.
It will also need to decide whether the government can regulate the way the platforms moderate content. And the outcome of the case will have a major impact on the future of the internet. And if the law is upheld, it could lead to a more fragmented and less free internet, but it could also make it more difficult to combat harmful content online. This is a case people should be watching, because this will have an impact on how they're going to be dealing with these centralized platforms. I just have to add, something like Nostra, I don't think is going to be subjected to this, but the centralized platforms certainly are going to be impacted by this decision. So keep your eyes open for this one. This is going to be game changing.
Nostra, famously, at least in Nostra circles, a protocol, not a platform. So it's difficult to make this kind of sweeping change. I don't have much to say about Section 230 because I'm not an expert, but I will recommend people who are listening and watching follow a guy named Preston Byrne, who we had on CVP maybe about a year ago. Yeah, when the UK court talked about digital shows, as they're called in British law, which is the French word for things. And so what he has to say about Section 230 is always interesting. He's been watching this for a long time. I personally am of the opinion that these content platforms should not be regulated like publishers. It doesn't make sense to me to have them regulated like that. They're providing a service that you can choose to use or not use. And, you know, if the issue is with monopolistic practices, that's a separate story. It's not a 230 story. But if you want more details, I would talk to Preston or message him or follow him on Twitter and see if you think that he's got some good insights. I believe that he does. I think he's a good resource for stuff like this.
Good memory. I totally forgot the fact that we had him on and the topic. That very good memory there. I missed that one. Anyways, let's talk about a AI controversy that leads Zooms to backpedal on updates to its terms of service. And there's a privacy storm that's brewing as Zoom updated the terms. Greenlight AI model training with user data from, this is from Zero Hedge. And I guess we had a few stories from Zero Hedge. This is one of them that made through. This is good. I always like reading stuff from Zero Hedge. Anyways, Zoom, a popular video conferencing platform. This made headways in 2020 after the lockdown. But anyways, they updated their terms of service to allow the company to use customer generated content for any purpose it sees fit, including to train artificial intelligent model. This change has been met with criticism from privacy activists, obviously, and they argue that it gives Zoom too much control over user data. They also worry that the company could use the data to track users' movement and their activities, even when they're not using the platform. And Zoom has defended the changes, saying that they're necessary to improve the platform security and functionality. The company also said it will not share the user's data with third parties without their consent. We've heard this many, many times, and here's another
time. Put it in the soundboard.
You know what? Just whatever. Privacy advocates are not convinced that they're going to do this. They say that the changes are too broad and it gives Zoom too much power. They're also concerned that the company's promises about privacy data are not credible. So these changes to the Zoom's terms of service are a reminder that there's importance here with our privacy in a digital age. And more of our lives are conducted online. It's essential we know what's happening with our data, how it's being used, how it's being controlled, and potentially how it's going to be sold moving forward. You know, this is crappy. Screw Zoom. That's all I got to say. Screw Zoom. If I never use them again, I'll be happy.
Sinking ship, right? Zoom famously just requested that all its employees are in the office 5 days a week. Like, talk about admitting your product doesn't work without admitting your product doesn't work. I think that's pretty telling. And so what do these guys do when they're out of ideas? This is like, you know, ordinals and rare Satoshis in the Bitcoin mining sphere. We got to find some other way to monetize the people that we already have on board with the technology we already have available. And what better way to do it than trade an AI model? Of course. And I hate this idea that, oh no, this is not going to be, we misworded it. The interpretation was incorrect because we miscommunicated. These guys they're talking about something in their terms that says they're going to use service generated data for the purpose of product and service development, marketing, analytics, quality assurance, machine learning, AI training, and testing. That's stealing data. That's all there is to it. Like, I'll use Zoom for free, or they can pay me for my data, but I'm not going to pay them to use a, you know, subpar, lower tier video conferencing service. You know, by the way, I'm not just saying it's lower tier because I'm shooting from the hip. When we started the other podcast, we were using Zoom. It sucked. The audio wasn't as good. The guesting wasn't as good. The video wasn't as good. Everything is better on a platform like StreamYard and stuff like that. And people are more familiar with these platforms now. Teams has a built-in, you know, a video conferencing service, much to the chagrin of antitrust hysterics all over the world. You know, and the list goes on of other options that are at least not explicitly are doing this. And by the way, you remember that Zoom was in some controversy early in its boom in 2020. Do you remember why?
No.
Because it was pinging Chinese servers. You don't remember that? So like, no, imagine, so it's like a Chinese outfit going, and now it's taking your data, your voice, your likeness, your sort of speaking style, all that stuff to train an AI model so that what somebody can, I don't know, like let's link it back to another story. The kid from Hamilton who was like ripping people off via SMS harvesting. So what? Someone's going to grab that honeypot of data, clone my voice and mannerisms, call my mobile service provider because I don't have 2FS enabled or whatever, and 2FA enabled, and then yank my bank information, my Bitcoin, my whatever, my fitness information, steal my phone number, steal my contacts. This is a nightmare. I don't want any, like, I don't want to use any service that does this. I actually should check to see if StreamYard does this too. Because I have not looked, but I honestly would, nothing would surprise me at this point. Everyone is trying to get in on this data harvesting stuff because, as we've talked about before, and I'm sure people who listen to and watch this show know, even without us telling them, data is the new oil, man. It is the big commodity of the next century. And we're starting to see that take shape all over the place now, without a doubt.
Yeah, I forget, there was a quote, I think for every 10,000 pieces of data on somebody, I think there was like a dollar figure to that. And it was nominal. It was $10 or $100 or something. It was something really cheap. So there's a black market price for data that's available for.
There is, a bunch for sure. And here's the story from TechCrunch in 2020. Zoom says during its efforts to ramp up server capacity to accommodate the massive influx of users over the past few weeks, it, quote, mistakenly allowed two of its Chinese data centers to accept calls as a backup in the event of network congestion. Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, the CCP
even if it's a mistake, like what other mistakes are you making? You know what I mean? Like fool me once, et cetera, you know the drill. I don't know. I'm over the data theft, man. The data breach.
Yeah, who's going to use Zoom moving forward? I hope nobody. And
not
if
me,
you
me,
are,
I'll tell you that much.
Just migrate away, find something else. Hopefully something that's open source that gives you the capabilities to do what you need. But yeah.
Every time Len says open source, have a drink. Okay, thanks everybody. That was number 310, Access of Easy. We'll see you next week for number 311. Until then, take care of yourselves and be good.
Yeah, take care.